Benvenuto Cellini, the famous Renaissance artist, is remembered most for work with his hands, both as a sculptor and a writer. But on May 6th, 1527, his hands would change the course of history, as he stood on the walls of Rome with an arquebus in hand, looking down on thousands of enemy invaders looking to scale Rome's walls. The young and unquestionably brave Cellini raised his arquebus and sighted it at a man fully armored and climbing up the wall, cloaked in a silver cape, and obviously the invading army's commander. He leveled that crude gun and fired off a ball that pierced what would prove to be the Duke of Bourbon, the powerful French prince, and possibly the most renowned traitor in French history. With the Duke on the ground, lying in a pool of his own blood, there would be no one to rein in these bloodthirsty troops, these invaders that would rout the outnumbered defenders and murder and pillage unabated for months, changing geopolitics and Christian theological landscape forever. Perhaps these changes would be less dramatic, though, had the invaders had their way. After all, many were there to capture or kill Pope Clement VII. Between them and their prize, however, stood about 200 Swiss guards sworn to protect the Pope with their life, of which all but 42 paid that price. Their sacrifice ensured the survival of Clement, whose survival would indirectly change the face of Italy, the Catholic Church, the Church of England, and Martin Luther's Reformation. In many ways, the world as we know it today. And that's why the last stand of the Swiss Guards is a battle you might not know, but should.
This is Battle Rattle. Battles you might not know, but should.
Hey everyone, this is Joe McGregor. I'm the host of Battle Rattle, and first of all, I want to thank you for listening to this episode and to the podcast. As you will likely notice, it's been a very long time since I've produced an episode. Part of that is because these episodes take so long to produce, got to read a lot of books, but also just life happens. So thanks for sticking around. And if you enjoy this podcast, I would very humbly ask that you take a moment to rate, review, and share it. It's becoming pretty cliche for those kinds of requests from content creators, but honestly, it's the single most helpful thing you could do. So if you enjoy it and you think others would enjoy it, please help us out by doing those things. Now on to the show. The famous Roman Emperor Hadrian, of Hadrian's Wall fame, commissioned a tomb to be built alongside Rome's Tiber River. He did such a good job with that building that not only were his ashes stashed there, but other subsequent Roman emperors were too, people like Marcus Aurelius. Eventually, all those ashes were scattered by looters during previous sackings of Rome, but one day a pope was sitting there and he thinks, hey, this mausoleum might make a good fortress. And so he commissioned the conversion over from a mausoleum to a fortress. Not only that, a few years later, another pope is sitting around thinking, you know what else is a good idea? Maybe, just in case the worst happens, I should build a secret passageway to get me from the Vatican over to this fortress. That fortress will be called Castel Sant'Angelo, and connecting Castel Sant'Angelo to the Vatican is a passageway called Passetto de Borgo. And this passageway is essentially the heart of our episode today. Before we go too far, one of my greatest struggles in these episodes is determining how much historical context to put in or leave out. As I mentioned earlier, I typically read several books in preparation for each episode, and no one wants to hear all that background, even if I think it's pretty interesting. At the same time, not only do these battles have a tremendous amount of context, but in many cases, that context reaches back hundreds, if not even more, years. In our case today, we're talking about at least 1,000 years of history. But don't worry, we're not going to do that. I'm going to try to condense it down as best I can, but I'm warning you, even with that, it's still going to be a little convoluted and complicated. But that is history. So without further ado, and to the cringe of the history buff, here we go. With the fall of Rome Italy had broken up into these tiny city-states. We have places like Florence, Milan, Venice, Naples, and a ton of other smaller states. Some were independent, some belonged to the papacy, and a lot of them changed hands. The same thing happened all across Europe to some degree or another. To complicate things, at times there were eras of consolidation, like under Charlemagne, who was crowned Holy Roman Emperor during his reign. But even after his death, that kingdom split. So you have these comings together, and for over 1,000 years, you have these political states. They're often warring with each other. They're getting conquered. People are getting absorbed into their neighbors. All that fun history stuff in the Middle Ages. And we all know, in order to make alliances, settle wars, expand territory, all those good things, the easiest way to do it, rather than fighting, is loving. And no family had perfected the art of marriage or conquest through marriage than the Habsburgs of Austria. So the Habsburgs, they hold on to their territorial possessions, not just through marriage, but a heck of a lot of intermarriage. And by 1527, the Habsburgs have a Burgundian king who rules the Netherlands, Germany, parts of Italy, and Spain. And in fact, the Habsburg Roman Emperor is the grandson of the famous Isabel and Ferdinand of Christopher Columbus fame. So for those of you map pros, you can imagine the map and see that it makes a pretty convenient U-shape around what we know is France. And France at this time is a powerful kingdom in its own right. Note that their king is actually a cousin of the Habsburgs, but for our purposes here, we need to acknowledge that France, because of this pressure, it feels like it's being surrounded as a potential takeover target. And while at the same time, has territories that are also in dispute, territories that France owns, that the Holy Roman Empire thinks belongs to it, and vice versa. And if that wasn't exciting enough, one of the other Habsburg marital successes was the infamous King Henry VIII of England. We all know who that is. Interestingly, he also styled himself as the King of France. And because, remember, they've been at war with France forever. So obviously, France feels threatened from them, not to add to the fact that Henry's wife is a Habsburg. It happens to be the Habsburg Emperor's aunt. So now France feels threatened on basically every side. And all these kings, they're all Christians, and they're feeling this collective pressure from Suleiman the Magnificent in Constantinople, who has this huge army, arguably just as large as all these European powers put together. And Suleiman has his sights set on Europe. And while we're not going to talk about that aspect of it, it's important to note two things. First, one of our next episodes is going to be about a wild battle known as Goons. And just generally speaking, if you have these European Christian kings, most of whom are pretty religious, and each of them know that there's this chance they'll be asked to join forces to fight people like Suleiman, then that's going to be in the back of their mind. So Suleiman, he's not in our cast of characters, but he definitely plays a role because he's in the mind of all of these rulers. And one last point. We have to remember that unlike today, especially unlike today's political environment, these kingdoms, they're not really national entities like we think of them. They're at least not fully formed as that. It's much more feudal. Many of them are constituted by smaller little fiefdoms where those lords owe allegiance to these lords. And sometimes those allegiances are weak or they shift or they're for sale. It creates some of the hostility and some of the unpredictability, the kind that can fuel war. If the political side wasn't enough, against all of these things happening, you have some turmoil happening within the Catholic Church. And I want to tread very respectfully here, but I think as a matter of history, I don't think there's any secret that not all popes and not all of the church apparatus were, I don't think they were always choir boys. The church had made sure to protect its viability, and often that came by way of selling offices, selling divorces, indulgences, these other things that kind of came under criticism by several critics. most notably, especially at this time, the critic Martin Luther. Luther was a German priest who was intensely critical, and intensely critical of the church in Rome, specifically. Luther's message resonated with his countrymen, which, as a reminder, constituted a large portion of the Holy Roman Empire. These early Lutherans, they varied in their intensity to these ideas. Some wanted to reform the church, others wanted to depart it entirely, and obviously the church wanted to hold on to them, either for monetary reasons, religious reasons. It was a situation where you had a lot of people who wanted to leave, or at least create an environment where reform could happen, and you had a church very, very resistant to that idea. And of course, again, there's our friend King Henry VIII. And about this time, he's asking Pope for permission to divorce his wife, which, again, is the Holy Roman Emperor's aunt. If this is granted, obviously the Habsburgs lose power and influence on that little island. And as far as the Catholic Church is concerned, we all know where Henry VIII took this question about allegiance to Rome. And in case you didn't, eventually he splits from Rome, and that's outside the events that we're talking about today, but you just need to know that this is one of the wheels in motion. So switching off the religious side and putting the political lens back on, you've got a Holy Roman Emperor where half of his subjects are thinking they might not want to be Catholic anymore, and the other half of his subjects, the Spaniards, who are among the most absolutely Catholic in all of the church. Then you have the King of France. He's leery about all this territorial threat surrounding him, literally surrounding him. But he also walks around with the title the most Catholic king. And then we've got an English king who wants France, but also who doesn't want his wife. The Pope can make that happen, but doesn't want to upset the Holy Roman Emperor. And the Pope, he's worried about losing power because the Holy Roman Emperor rules over people pretty hostile to the Pope. And the Pope knows that his influence in political matters will wane if the Holy Roman Emperor achieves much more power. Gotta keep it in check. So how confusing is that? And this is only a fraction of it. This is the 30,000-foot view of it. Basically, in summary, everyone hates everyone else, no one trusts anyone, and they're all willing to go to war for it. Maybe one last historical context note. Rome, at this point in time, you know, 1527, it's no longer holding the weight that it once had under the Roman Empire, but it's still a very important city. It houses the Vatican. It's a center of trade. Rome had her defenses, but much of her warfare, it's actually carried out through dispatches, ordering and orchestrating, dealing with theology and politics all throughout the Christian world. So it's not really used to, you know, it doesn't have a great martial history like the one it used to have. So even though this great city fathered probably one of the greatest military forces the world has ever known, not anymore. By 1527, it's just simply a regular town. A big town, but just a regular town. So much so that while most of the city is guarded by this 30-foot-high wall, the Aurelian walls, as we will see, there were gaps in the defenses. Gaps that should not have been there, were probably easy to fix, but because no one's paying attention, there they are. And maybe to compound the matter, Rome was largely an ecclesiastical community, meaning the ecclesiastics are the ones who are doing a lot of the civic duties that you would expect to see. So you're missing this inherent command structure and possibly missing that same sense of affinity, community amongst your other town folk. So the point is, neither Rome nor Rome's defenses are very prepared for any kind of fight. Let's hit the pause button and let's talk about our cast of characters. Now, half of these people, they're not actually going to play a direct role in our battle, but because they played such an important role for the forces, we've got to talk about it. First up, King Charles V, most Catholic king of Spain and the Holy Roman Emperor. Charles is a very interesting character, and I feel he's maybe even a little underrated throughout history. And in fact, it seems that he is one of the characters in history that we have the most knowledge about because he wrote so many things. He was the first transatlantic emperor. He was Flemish, Burgundian, and he had control over the Netherlands, Germany, Spain, a lot of Italian states, and of course, the New World. So Charles is born in 1500. His dad is this renowned philanderer. His mom goes crazy, so crazy that when Charles's dad dies, she has him exhumed, brought the coffin into her room, and wouldn't let anybody touch it. And she was so messed up from the philandering that when female servants would come into the room, she would go to the defense. Don't ask me. I don't know. But she was pretty crazy. But young Charles was definitely groomed for this job. He had tutors. He was taught multiple languages, especially the languages of the empire. He was very cultured, very prepared. And I would point out that it at least appears that he was genuinely interested in the natives of the New World and at least expressed a desire to treat them as best as possible. Unfortunately for Charles, though, the inbreeding thing of the Habsburgs did catch up with him a little bit. One of his most famous attributes is that he had this like massive underbite. His jaws, they basically didn't line up, and it made it hard for him to talk. People had a hard time understanding him, and it made it hard for him to eat. Must have been pretty crazy jaw. Next, we have King Francis I of France. He is Charles V's arch enemy. Interestingly, he wasn't directly in line to become king. A few people had to die and a few things had to happen in order for him to ascend the throne. And it was a little unexpected, but king he became. He was less devout than Charles, and one of his favorite sports was whoring. One of the precipitating events in our battle is that Francis mobilized a huge army to march south and regain some of those Italian territories that he thought should be his. He suffered a most humiliating defeat to Charles at a battle called Pavia, a battle that changed warfare forever. We might even talk about it in a future episode because that's where one of the battles where we learn that guns are the new thing and that armor is probably not going to help us against them. But I mention it here because this defeat was so thorough that not only was the French army basically annihilated, but Francis himself was captured by Charles's army. And in exchange for his life, Charles extracts these very humiliating terms. And Francis was asked to give his word as a knight and a Christian that he would honor his word if he was released back to France. I know what all of us are saying, like, hey, that would be a pretty dumb thing to trust in. But Charles V trusted Francis. He thought he would honestly uphold his end of the bargain. Spoiler alert, he did not. He basically did none of the things. But it tells us two things. Number one, Charles is the type of guy who's willing to make promises to his friends and foes and just not keep them. But it also kind of gives us this peek into Charles V's mind that possibly that if the roles were reversed, his honor would actually make him fulfill the terms that he agreed to. So two very, very different people, and they hate each other, or at least they hate each other now. Next, we have Pope Clement VII. He was a member of the Medici family, the family that nearly single-handedly was responsible for the Renaissance. It's important to understand that Clement was Florentine. He wasn't Roman. And the way the city-states worked, Romans considered him a foreigner. So we think of both of them as Italian cities. That's not how they thought of it back then. And that does have some relevancy for us today. Clement was a very well-educated young man as he was being brought up. He was very well-regarded as a cardinal, very thorough, very detail-oriented. He was relied upon a lot by previous popes for his opinion on how to handle things. He's very good about gathering all the information and presenting it to the popes. And honestly, that was one of the reasons he eventually was elected as Pope. Clement, though, once he became Pope, he carried the weight of the consequences of his decision, and it kind of destabilized him, it would seem. Because from that point forward, reports are that he suffered a lot of anxiety. He would have these spells where he's out there talking to himself. He was not great at handling all this responsibility and being in situations where he made a decision and instantly there are consequences, some of which he didn't foresee or didn't intend. Now, to be fair, and history isn't very fair to Clement. Honestly, Clement walked into a pretty tough situation and at a pretty critical juncture of history. Most of these obstacles were not of Clement's making. We've already talked about the emergence of reformers, people like Martin Luther. They existed before Clement was ever a pope. And in fact, it's probably useful to point out that Clement lived his life in a way that probably wouldn't have earned that ire from some of the reformers, some of the Protestants. He seems to have been a very devout Christian, very devout believer, and a man of integrity, man who kept his word, who didn't believe in some of the practices that his fellow cardinals were engaging in. One example is that he didn't believe in the selling of cardinal hats. He thought those should go to people who deserve them. At a critical juncture, a little bit later in our story, he's going to sell 5 of those hats so he can raise money. And it's just, he's kind of forced into it. But it's not the type of thing, because he is the type of guy who wants the church to do the quote-unquote right thing. But one of the most influential facts is that he took over a papacy that was nearly bankrupt. And this had 2 consequences. First of all, no money is hard to work with, right? You need money to make things happen. Most of the money was exhausted by none other than his cousin, Leo X, who was 2 popes before. Unfortunately, the money was spent on a lot of things that didn't have like lasting effect. Leo would throw these huge parties. It would be so well catered. They'd spend tons of money on it. These processionals, parades, things like that. And he spent a lot of money. Remember, these are Renaissance guys. And so he spent a lot of money on artists, a little bit on public works. But he's definitely not being responsible. And he's spending more money than the papacy has. So the more reasonable Clement, he has to step in and he has to stop that kind of stuff, which almost instantly unemploys most of the artists in the city. And if you can imagine, doesn't make him very popular. Next, and this is getting a little bit more relevant to us, next we have the Duke of Bourbon. And that's bourbon for you day drinkers, and maybe that's just how I'll pronounce his name going forward. But we have the Duke of Bourbon, and he is a tragic figure. Wish we could talk more about him, but this guy was the Constable of France, and he was basically the second in command in all of France. He was a member of French nobility. He was part of the royal family. He was very popular in France until he turned traitor. Now, history seems to not be able to articulate exactly when and why he turned traitor. We have some ideas, but the short version is that despite being really, really young, he was an abled commander that gained respect among his men. But slowly, Francis, King of France, starts giving him like worse and worse assignments, kind of so much so that it's an insult. Now, we do know that Francis's mother made romantic overtures on the Duke of Bourbon, to which he not only rejected, but rejected in a pretty public fashion. That may have played a role. But either way, Francis is kind of sidelining the Duke of Bourbon for no real reason. He's pretty upset about it. Probably some jealousy involved. But one day, Francis, he decides, you know what, let's just cut to the chase and let's arrest Bourbon. Once the world finds out that there's some stress fractures in the royal family, Charles V, of course, he sends overtures over to Bourbon saying, hey, how much do you like Francis? You ever think about playing for the other team, coming over to our side? And that's where Francis says, let me cut this off right now, and tries to arrest him. Bourbon flees with nothing but his clothes, no retainers. So you got this dude who's so used to living in luxury. He's got castles and castles, all that stuff. He barely escapes, and he's going to spend the rest of his life effectively in exile. He's this lone wolf looking for a cause, looking for a job, basically. And King Charles's grudge against Francis makes the two of them a perfect match. Next, we have George von Frundsberg. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. But he was the father of a fighting unit called the Lanschkönigs. Also pronouncing that wrong, but that's what we're going to do. These Lanschkönigs, they are these German fighting units. And we mentioned von Frundsberg because he's essentially the father of them. Like, he's shaping them. They have these contracts, these structures. He turns these kids into highly disciplined mercenary soldiers. And he is going to command about 14,000 of them. The men love him. That's one thing that becomes a little tragic. They love Frundsberg. Even though he's super old, he's their commander. They'll do whatever he says, and they go to fight for him. Not so much for Charles V, even though that's their nominal emperor. They're there for von Frundsberg. And finally, we have a young man named Caspar Royce. Not that young. He's about 40 years old at the time. He is the captain of the Swiss Guards. The Swiss Guards, we're going to talk about them here in a second, but they were the guards who guarded the Pope. Caspar is super well-educated. He's super well-connected back in Switzerland. That's how he gets the job. But the Pope originally wanted his dad to form up these Swiss Guards, but his dad's too old, so that falls to the dad's son, which is actually Caspar's brother. Caspar gets this job, and he is the one that puts this version of the Swiss Guards together. He recruits them, he gets them down there, and he trains them to become an extremely effective fighting force, as we will see. On May 6th, every year, new recruits are sworn into the Swiss Guards. The Swiss Guard are charged with protecting the Pope. So wherever the Pope goes, the Swiss Guard go too. They are one of the oldest standing armies in the world, and according to some historians or historian, they are the oldest standing army in the world. Depends on how you define it, but there you go. If you want to be in the Swiss Guard, you have a couple of requirements. Number one, you got to be Catholic. You need recommendations from your pastor. You have to be at least 5'9", and you have to be in good health. You have to be an experienced member of the Swiss fighting force. You also have to be single. And I think it goes without saying, you have to be Swiss. Now, we can't spend too much time on the history of the Swiss Guards. What you need to know is that generally, you constantly have concerns about the Pope's safety, right? So you need some force to protect the Pope. This is just a thing. It's even modernly, we have this, not even just of kings and religious leaders. A lot of people have bodyguards, and that's what they needed. They needed some bodyguards for the Pope, but they also had some concerns about loyalties. And at the time when the Swiss Guards were formed, the Swiss were actually considered to be, if not the most elite fighting force, among the most elite. So it made sense from an actual military safety perspective. And most of Switzerland is Catholic, so it's going to be easy to find people who fit your requirements. And the Swiss Guard continue their role today. If you go to the Vatican now, you're going to encounter Swiss Guard. So that's our background, mostly. Now it is Cinco de Mayo, 1527. We're outside the walls of Rome. There are about 22,000 troops of Charles V's Holy Roman Empire imperial troops camped right outside. The troops are starving, and they are starving for a fight. It's been several long months for this multinational army, and they can smell victory. Now, how did this multinational army show up at the gates of Rome? First of all, let's remember, Italy is two things. It's super rich, and it's not an actual country, not at this time anyway. It's composed of these city-states, and ownership of one or more has these political and economic implications. And of course, we've already talked about how, like, conquest, whether militarily or through marriage, that is one way these change hands and sometimes kind of changes back on each other. So you go conquer a place and marry someone from there, but then three generations later, they get conquered by someone else. Anyway, it's created this huge mess, especially in northern Italy. Now, most recently, Clement's cousin, we talked about him, Leo X, he used these various, like, competing factions across Europe. He used them for his own end, particularly pitting Spain and France against each other. Probably the most direct route we can trace to 1527 is when Francis's predecessor, Francis the king, not the country, when he invaded Italy and he captured the city of Milan, where our friend Christian Pulisic plays soccer. And the Pope, he's nervous that this might inspire further encroachments, so the Swiss, long before they started their neutrality thing, they move in and they dislodge the French. And by the way, the Swiss were super excellent pikemen. That was kind of how they gained their fame. But then Francis takes over in France. He wins a decisive battle against the Swiss, pretty much through treachery of the Venetians. That's another theme. Italians are willing to turn their back on other Italians. But again, they didn't really think of themselves as Italians. So now the papacy feels threatened. They've got this potential French invasion again. Francis is warned, though, that if he pushes too far, then England, the Holy Roman Empire, and the Swiss, they're all going to come together and fight against him. So Francis, and remember, he's super young king so far, he thinks it would be best for now to demonstrate to the world that he has no intentions on an actual full-scale invasion, at least not of the entire Italian peninsula. So he meets up with the Pope. A very important treaty. With that, Francis also worked out a deal with the Swiss, and this would kick off Switzerland's policy of neutrality, mainly as a way to stay out of costly wars and to appease the growing split between the Catholics of the country and the Protestants. Then our friend Charles V, he inherits the Kingdom of Spain and then subsequently is elected Holy Roman Empire. Our good friend Leo X dies and is replaced by a Flemish pope, a dude who is Charles V's personal tutor. So does that assuage everyone's fear? It does not. This pope is taking over a near bankrupt papacy, and unlike many other recent popes, this guy's actually a devout man of God. This guy's name is Adrian. Many don't like their inability to influence him, especially through money. What matters most is that in his efforts to clean up the bank accounts, he dismisses a lot of the soldiers and he ceases a lot of the public works that are happening around Rome. But then, in 18 months, he dies. And now we need a new pope. There are two top candidates, and one is Clement VII, who is a Medici, and the Medici rule Florence. The other one is Cardinal Colonna, who is a Roman, one of the most powerful families in Rome, if not the most powerful. And Clement wins, particularly through siding with France, getting support from there. And Cardinal Colonna, he doesn't really appreciate losing to Clement, and he thinks, I'm going to make this guy pay. But what Clement does is he says, you know what, I'm going to make peace, so I'm going to make Colonna my vice pope. It's not the real name for it, but it's what we're going to call it. And what does Colonna do? It's kind of wild, but he responds by invading Rome. That's right. The second guy in the Catholic Church invades Rome. It's not the sack of Rome, but it is an invasion. Turns out to be a little uneventful, but we learn two things. Number one, first, Colonna's army basically just walks through the gates, so we know the defenses are not good. And second, the Roman citizens celebrated their liberator, and we know he's a Roman, they're Romans, but we learn Romans as a citizenry are not going to be terribly useful if we actually have to fight. Well, Colonna and Clement, they work out a deal and life moves on. This is after all the Middle Ages and more treacherous things can happen. And while we have this going on, we still have Francis of France and Charles of everywhere else kind of jockeying for position. And again, they both have their eyes set on this very wealthy peninsula of Italy. So in 1525, we have one of the most absolute famous battles. We've talked about it already. It's called Pavia. Suffice it to say, we don't have time to talk about it at all, but during the battle, that's where they obliterate the French and they capture King Francis. One thing I didn't mention as part of that deal is that Charles negotiates for the reinstatement of Bourbon, and that's one of the promises that the King of France reneges on instantly. Now Charles knows that he can't really trust Francis, and Bourbon knows that if he's ever going to get anything back, he's basically got to go for gold, and it's got to result in Francis's demise. But this amazing victory leaves Charles V, for now, unopposed in Europe. And everybody wonders what this guy's going to do. The Pope thinks, or at least fears, that he might try to take over the entire Italian peninsula. And he's also pretty sure that Charles wants to replace him, Clement. And that actually turns out to be true. He did want a more pliable pope. And he wanted it for a few reasons. First of all, Charles is still sore that Clement sided with France. And second, Charles is trying to keep his Protestant subjects in Germany pretty happy. And that would be one way to do it. And then finally, and arguably the most noble of the reasons, is, again, remember, Suleiman the Magnificent is trying to take over Europe. And Charles thinks that it's going to be a lot easier if he has control of all of the armies of Europe, and he better be able to fight off the Turks. Here's our real problem, though. Charles isn't paying his troops. Wars are expensive. He doesn't have a ton of money of his own. In March of 1527, Charles has entered into a new peace treaty with Francis, thereby lessening the need to even pay his army. Bourbon and von Frunsberg, they did what they could to hold things together, but without pay and without money to even buy food, things are getting pretty bleak. You don't necessarily want over 20,000 soldiers just roaming around the countryside. So von Frunsberg and Bourbon, they do what they can to keep discipline. And back at the Vatican, we also have another interesting development. The Swiss Guard, for a couple of political and some religious reasons, they're recalled back to Zurich, or at least the ones from Zurich. But their captain, Caspar Royce, he knows this is a pretty bad idea because it's a really bad time to leave the Pope unguarded. So what he decides to do is ignore the order. He thinks, I'm going to stick around until the coast is clear. It never will be. The imperial forces under Bourbon, they're deciding the only way they're actually going to get paid for what they've done is to walk down to Rome and take what they deserve. Italy, it's the richest European country. They probably got tons of money there. And Rome is its veritable capital. So that's what they do. They marshal at Bologna, and we've got 14,000 Lanzknechts, 6,000 Spanish troops, and about 3,000 Italians, and they head southward. They march down to Rome, almost literally starving. Along the way, they extract what they can from the city-states that they pass. But basically, they're just trying to ransom off people's safety. There's very little to extract, at least not without engaging in extensive siege warfare. So they did what they could. They got down to Rome as fast as they could. And in some ways, it wasn't fast enough because the Germans, they're super tired, super frustrated, and one of them draws a pike against von Frunsberg. Von Frunsberg draws a sword, but the whole action gives von Frunsberg a stroke. They cart him back to Germany, basically dying of a broken heart. So now it's just the Duke of Bourbon. He's a Frenchman in charge of this huge army that's not French. And he's just, like I said, doing what he can to keep it together. And at one point, it's so desperate that he pawns off every single thing he has except his cape. Rome realized that no one was going to stop or buy off this advancing army. This imperial army, they have no heavy artillery, and they're starving, right? So they have to go as fast as they can. They're basically one huge flying column. But what it does is it makes them or allows them to make incredible time getting to Rome faster than anybody expected. And the mood in Rome right now is very mixed. Many can't fathom the idea of an invading army. Many knew that most of the invaders are Catholics. They can't imagine that a Catholic army is going to attack the most Catholic city. And probably most of them, and this is probably a fair take, a lot of them think, you know what? We've seen this before. They're just going to pay off that army so that they'll leave us alone. That's what happened in other places in Italy. Why wouldn't it happen in Rome? And in fact, Bourbon makes this a very distinct possibility. He made several overtures to the Vatican saying, hey, we will leave you alone if you pay us enough. And he named a price that would be high enough to both get his troops paid, but also have enough to provision the army to get them out of that part of Italy. Unfortunately, remember, the papal treasury is just bone dry. They can't make that kind of ransom. And Bourbon and all these troops, especially the Spaniards, they're like, there's no way the papacy doesn't have money. They're playing with us. So that actually enrages them. Clement's money problem wasn't just that he couldn't buy off Bourbon. He had no money to pay for mercenaries to come help him either. Clement made desperate pleas to the governors of the papal states nearby and to other people in his league of support, you know, France and Venice, places like that, but they're not going to get there in time. And the governors of these papal states, they don't respond. Things are getting so desperate that Clement calls like a council of the richest families in Rome, and he asks them for money, and they just mock him. They jeer him out of the room. And if only they knew what was about to happen. Attack looks inevitable. Clement rounds up all of the fighting-age men, and the numbers for the defenders vary pretty wildly in the sources, anywhere from about 5,000 to about 14,000. Still enough, though, to defend Rome. Now, I will point out, one of the reasons it's difficult to ascertain, to put a number on the defenders, is because they basically grabbed everyone. There are some professional soldiers in the city. Some of these professional soldiers are employed by the wealthy families. Some are constituted in small little armies. But a lot of these people are just people. They're shopkeepers. They're servants. They're artists. In fact, most of the artists of the city, they're put in charge of the artillery and the arquebuses under the theory that they're better with their hands, and so they'll probably shoot straighter. And that's how the goldsmith slash sculptor Benvenuto Cellini, that's how he ends up with an arquebus. And Clement, to get ready, he appoints a military commander, and he has various groups of people guarding various places along the wall. Bourbon's army, they arrive from the north, and because he has no siege equipment and literally his men are starving, he's got like one day of rations. He knows he's got to make a move pretty instantly, so he doesn't linger. He puts out one last ransom attempt, and when Clement can't meet it, he's like, all right, let's do this. He's going to launch his attack on May 6th, 1527. In order to do this, he divides his force into two main units. The smaller force, they're going to attack from the north down the Tiber River. But this is just a diversionary force meant to scatter or like spread out the defenders. And one military mistake that the defenders make is that they basically try to guard the wall in spread out equally rather than waiting for the pressure points. Bourbon would take the main force and attack the west side of Rome, the side that's west of the Tiber River, for those of you who are familiar with Rome or know how to look at a map. They're going to attack the west side. And then Bourbon is further going to divide this main attack force into three pieces. And then he's going to use that to attack. The main thrust of his attack is going towards the what they consider and what they expect to be the weakest part of the wall. So it's the night before. Bourbon's super calm. The imperial troops, they're canvassing the Campania, the fields nearby. They're canvassing for lattice work so that they can make scaling ladders. Bourbon, he meets with his confessor and confides his will. The camp's quiet. Every man knows what's about to happen tomorrow. It's 4 a.m. The imperial forces, they've mustered. Bourbon hops on his charger with his white silver-ish coat, and he rides around to all his men, encouraging them, telling them all the heroic deeds they've done in the past and what's expected of them today. And the attack commences. The imperial forces converge on Rome. Roman artillery repulse this initial attack. The imperial troops, they regroup with fresh troops, and together they go back in. They place their ladders against the city walls, but the Roman defenders, they're easily pushing these ladders down. It's actually looking like a pretty futile attack. But then something crazy happens. A fog rolls in. Not just a fog, but a super thick fog where no one can see the ground. In about an hour, the Roman defenders, they can't really see what's out there beyond the wall. They can hear the imperial forces. They can't see much. And so they stop firing their cannon. The Duke of Bourbon is out there riding around, rallying his men, trying to keep pressure on the walls. And he sees an opportunity to utilize the fog as an advantage. So he dismounts and he determines to lead by example. So he's going to lead this charge. He grabs one of the ladders and he places it against the wall and he starts climbing up, yelling encouragement to his men. Now the defenders, they can't see anyone on the ground. But as the attackers surface above the fog, they make an easy target for the arquebusiers. And we have our friend Benvenuto Cellini, that Renaissance sculptor. He's one such arquebusier. He sees this regal figure peek out of the cloud. Cellini points down. His match drops into the firing pin, igniting the priming powder and triggering an explosion out the barrel that propels a small bullet into Bourbon's groin. Bourbon falls back. He's dragged to safety, but he's bleeding out, and he dies shortly thereafter. For the moment, the fortunes of the battle look to turn. Bourbon, the only commander that the imperialists really respected, he's just dying or is now dead. They are commanderless, and Cellini knows the man he just hit, that white surcoat, he gave it away. The defenders get so excited that so many of them abandon the wall and they run off in celebration, kind of like in soccer when someone celebrates a goal only to have it called offsides. This was a false hope. The number of defenders on the top of the wall, it's thin, and that allows the imperialists, with this renewed ferocity, they take the wall and clear the battlements from the defenders, allowing even more troops to make it over. While the situation at the top of the wall worsens, you have other imperial troops scanning the city, poking around, looking for weaknesses in the wall, and they find one. There's a sliver of an opening, and the German Landsknechts use a pickaxe to chip at the wall to just widen it a little bit, and they create just enough space for a single man to squeeze through, which should have been pretty easy to defend, just one guy at a time, but the appearance of these German soldiers scared off the potential defenders, and so the imperialists, they just walk right in. And this suggests that no one seems to have done a very good job at all of inspecting the walls, because some Spanish troops also found that in the wall was a window on a ground floor building. The troops punch out this window, which led to a little tiny cantina. They open the door through that cantina, and they can't believe their luck. They're inside the city. They're just walking around. And they're just as surprised as the Romans are who see them. And of all people to encounter them first was Rome's military commander, the guy who had been placed as military commander. And he's so shocked, so surprised, that he doesn't even draw a sword. He just turns around and runs, and he cries, "The city's lost." And with that, of course, the city is lost. Now, in reality, if the Romans can just keep the imperialists on the west side of the Tiber, they might be able to save the city. Unfortunately, the Romans just didn't have the heart to destroy their bridges. And so, one last stand was made by several hundred Romans lined up at Ponte Sisto. Included in this cohort were several of Rome's nobility, like the higher bred people, including several knights. The Landsknechts advance across the bridge, and as soon as contact was made, the Romans were just cut down, nearly every single one of them. There were no match for these professional, inexperienced soldiers, except for one knight who seemed impossible to kill, and at least one eyewitness claimed that he was the most heroic of any fighters of the day. But eventually, even he falls. Another militia unit guarding one of the suburbs suffered 90% casualties, And another unit firing the artillery, they're wiped out to the last man. So we don't want to make it sound like no Romans tried to defend their city, but even the ones that had heart to fight, they were just no match for not just professional soldiers, but experienced professional soldiers who were bloodthirsty. And by now, you have thousands of them pouring into the city, basically unopposed. And at this point in the day, which is still the morning, we guess that about 3,000 Roman defenders have already been killed, and it's barely lunch. We think that fewer than 100 Imperial soldiers have died. And now the city has descended into almost total anarchy, pure chaos. There's no longer any semblance of organized defense except in one place. And that's back over on the west side in the Vatican. And included in that resistance was our hero Caspar Royce with his Swiss guards. Remember, these soldiers are there to defend the Pope, who has spent the bulk of the battle praying in his little private chapel. His cardinals have urged him to escape to the safety of Castel Sant'Angelo, but he refuses for whatever reason. So the Swiss guards, along with some other Romans, they're right outside protecting the approach to St. Peter's Basilica, which is actually under construction at the time, but it was the approach to get to the Pope, and so they're there to defend it. 142 Swiss guards, all sworn to protect the Pope's life with their own, they line up, ready to receive the attackers, who finally break into the Vatican, seeking out the Pope. These Imperial troops, they're thinking that most of the loot must be nearby in the vaults of the Vatican. So they attack with fury. The Swiss decimate the attackers. They've got slightly higher ground, and many of them are armed with halberds that they're very experienced with. But one of the first to be wounded is Caspar Royce. He's dragged away from the battlefield and taken to his apartment nearby. Meanwhile, the Swiss continue to fight. More and more Imperial troops fill the Vatican, and one by one, the Swiss guards fall. And finally, the last one of them is killed. 142 Swiss guard lay dead or dying, surrounded by almost 1,000 Imperial attackers. The sacrifice buys Clement's retainers enough time to finally convince him that he needs to get out of the Vatican. So he escapes to Castel Sant'Angelo. Over 3,000 people in Rome had already had this idea, knowing that this would be probably the safest place in the city. But the castle filled up so fast that the defenders had to drop the portcullis, killing at least one person in the process. And for this very contingency, a previous pope, remember, had built that passageway, the Passetto. 42 Swiss guards, all that remained, were Clement's personal bodyguards. And they, along with another cardinal, dashed Clement along this raised passageway. And the cardinal raised up his purple cloak to disguise Clement. Clement makes it safely to Castel Sant'Angelo, and the Swiss guards' sacred duty has been fulfilled. For now, Pope Clement is safe. The Imperial troops, they ransack the Vatican. They find Caspar Royce still bleeding from his wounds. A soldier starts to hack at him, but Caspar's wife tries to intervene with her own body, losing some fingers in the process. But they brutally torture Caspar and make her and Caspar's son make him watch as they kill Caspar. It's the afternoon, and the battle has now transitioned into a ransack. The Imperial soldiers, they're going house to house, obviously focusing on the big houses, but they're just looking for anything of value that they can take. They kill anyone who resists. They torture homeowners into confessing their hiding spots, and the Imperial soldiers catalog all their loot with kind of an eerie precision, but they're cataloging everything that they take. The last vestiges of anything that resembles a battle are actually these household guards that are guarding some of the wealthy families. In one case, a woman of the city hired 70 mercenaries to guard her home before the battle. And unlike most mercenaries, they actually fought to the last man. And the Imperial soldiers eventually killed the woman too. Not even supporters of the emperor were safe. Cardinal Colonna's own household was stripped. And of course, many would think he deserved it, and much more, and probably you would be right. Relatives of the Italian attackers were not even spared. Their houses were attacked, everything of value taken, coins were measured, gold was weighed, the artwork looted, and in fact, historians think maybe as much as 90% of the artwork in Rome was destroyed during this sack. And remember, this is High Renaissance, so you have all that ancient artwork and some of this other artwork that would have been tremendously valued to today and even at the time. In one particular insulting move, the German Lutherans even managed to write Luther on one of Michelangelo's murals in the Vatican, which is actually still there to this day. Clement and his small little contingent, they stayed holed up in Castel Sant'Angelo as they watched the horror, what's happening in the city. At least one priest was hung outside a window by his genitalia. Others were tortured for sport. The Spaniards were particularly cruel. They would torture until citizens divulged hiding spots and then sometimes kill their victim anyway. They invaded convents and ravaged all inside. Many citizens in Rome assumed that the convent would be a safe place. So not only did they go to the convent, but they would take all their valuables. And then, of course, once these invaders figured it out, it kind of backfired because now they know where to get both loot and women. Historians and poets who were eyewitness to the sacking, they lamented that history had no equal to the depravity that they saw. There were no limits to the imperial troops' like brutality, their creativity in creating torturous ways to extract information out of people. When a city that doesn't capitulate, when they force someone to invade them, if they lose, there's kind of this unwritten rule that there's 3 days worth of sacking. For Rome, this carried on for months. They refused to leave until their obscene ransom for Clement was paid. And since Clement genuinely had no money, it took quite some time to raise the ransom. Eventually, terms were met. There were opportunities for Charles to intervene, but he took none. Some would argue that this is exactly the result he hoped for. Also, there were two different armies that had the opportunity, one at the very outset of the battle, but armies that were outside of Rome that could have come to the help, and neither one chose to engage the imperial troops. Now, what eventually motivated the departure of the imperial troops were, you have to remember, there's like thousands of dead bodies in the streets, and the situation, the sanitation situation, is broken down so much that, you know, the water's contaminated. There was no money to speak of left. All the valuables have been looted. And with these unsanitary conditions, the plague returns. And so after months of this brutal occupation, with almost no women retaining their virtue and no family retaining anything of value, the army finally leaves and Clement is returned to the Vatican. Clement was forced to make quite a lot of concessions to Charles, and Charles would indirectly be able to control Clement for the rest of Clement's rule. This battle and the fact that the Swiss Guard sacrifice enabled the Pope to survive it would have repercussions that we still feel today, particularly us in the Western world. First, Clement was forced by Charles to hold a council where Lutherans were effectively given voice, which led to their formal departure from the Catholic Church. Second, King Henry, he wanted to divorce his wife, which wasn't a terribly unusual request, except that, remember, Charles's aunt was Henry's wife, so of course, Clement would have to refuse because of Charles. And that set in motion the formation of the Church of England. For Rome, she wouldn't recover for a few centuries. At the start of this battle, we estimate that as many as 90,000 people called Rome their home. That rhymes. 9 months later, though, she probably had less than 10,000 people. Most of Rome's artists and creatives, they left for other cities like Florence and Venice or left the country. And so much valuable artwork and books containing history, they're all destroyed. All the literati and creatives, they're gone. So it's not going to get replaced anytime soon. The sacrifice of the Swiss Guards on May 6, 1527, exemplifies duty to just the highest order. They all knew they were going to die. They all fought to the last man. Their commitment to their oath bought the mere seconds or minutes needed to allow Clement to escape, and who's escaped changed the history of the world forever. And that's why the last stand of the Swiss Guards is a battle you might not know, but should.
This is Battle Rattle. Battles you might not know, but should.